Welcome to the GovLabs Collective Intelligence Podcast, which highlights how institutions are using new technologies to engage residents in solving problems. The GovLab is a partner project of the Burn Center for Social Change at Northeastern University. Today, we're joined by Pratik Buch and Brendan Arnold of UK Government's Policy Lab and its new Collective Intelligence Lab. Pratik has served as a research scientist, political advisor, and technology entrepreneur, and is a prominent voice in advocating for the responsible and ethical use of technology to address social and political issues. Brendan has been a physicist, a maker, and has worked in the private sector before Policy Lab, and is likely central government's first creative technologist, a role that applies design thinking and technical know-how to policy innovation, and we hope not the last. Today, we're talking about how Collective Intelligence Lab uses technology to gather, analyze, and understand what UK residents think. Pratik, Brendan, thank you for joining us today. Can we start off right away by just having you both tell us a little bit about Collective Intelligence Lab and what inspired its creation? Maybe Pratik, you can kick us off here and tell us about the problem that the Collective Intelligence Lab is solving.
Be a pleasure, and it's a pleasure to be with you today, Beth. The interesting genesis of our Collective Intelligence Lab is actually in its origins around conversations in the national security space in the UK, where efforts were being made to open up the way policy was designed by bringing in diverse voices, by trying to combat groupthink. And many of the reasons why UK government started to experiment with collective intelligence was for reasons that apply to other areas of policy beyond the national security space, the intention to bring voices into the policymaking arena that don't usually get listened to, for instance, or to generate new, fresh ideas, or to broaden, deepen, the extent to which government institutions understand the problem space that they're sort of in. So 2 years ago, we began experimenting with collective intelligence methods, really small scale, and Brendan can perhaps talk about kind of the choices we've made for how we've run those experiments. And I guess the problem we're trying to solve, in a way, is how can we tap into the collective wisdom or the hive mind of groups of people around specific topics that at any one time government is tasked with solving.
So I would love to get into a little bit, who are the collectives that you're tapping into, and to hear about the platforms that you're using to do that. Maybe you can just help us to understand a little bit more, what are the lab's kind of initial priorities? What policy areas you've been focusing on in the first instance? I know you talked about it growing out of a sort of national security focus. Where are you now in terms of the work that you've been doing over the last year? And I'll invite you to self-moderate and either or both of you to jump in as you prefer.
Yeah, I guess it's probably worth setting a little bit of context and thinking about Collective Intelligence Lab growing out from a wider policy lab, which is a team that was set up 9 years ago now to radically improve policy outcomes by bringing design thinking and people-centered approaches into government and through innovative methods. And Policy Lab hosting our collective intelligence function means that we effectively work on the projects that come to us. We're a commission-driven team, so other bits of government will come to us and ask for help on their challenges. So to date, we've worked on collective intelligence, we've worked in the national security space, as we mentioned, we've worked on kind of organizational design. How should the UK civil service be refined and reformed in different ways? We've worked on topics on environmental policy and a number of different topics in that space. So we work on the priorities that other parts of government have for us. And Brendan, I guess I think I'm right in saying that our priorities are to explore where collective intelligence methods may add most value.
Maybe this is a great time, Brendan, we could bring you into this conversation and also have you tell us a little bit more as you answer Pratik's prod to you about the how of this. So you've been very specifically choosing to use POLIS, an open source platform, and just really interested in kind of the vision for why this platform and what it does for you in the ways that you think about collective intelligence that might help people better understand what you mean by that.
Sure, yeah. So I might start out just with a brief introduction of what Polis is. So just to go into it, it's an open source bit of software. It's been developed by a group called Computational Democracy. And it's been used to great effect in places like Taiwan as part of the digital ministry there to engage citizens to generate ideas. But essentially the system is hosted on the internet, on the web. And it's ultimately a virtual suggestion box. So a series of suggestions are put in into the system. They all live discreetly, they're generally sort of Twitter length. Things like, I think that e-scooters should be allowed to operate on the sidewalk, for example. And people get to vote on these statements, and they get to, you know, agree, disagree, and they can pass as well if they're not quite sure or they don't understand it. But they can also refine the statement, so they can add an additional statement into the system. So it becomes this self-generating, quite grassroots-led, and sort of takes this very sort of the opposite of top-down, essentially. So it becomes generated by the population, and it really gives people the chance to put out the ideas that they have inside of them for everyone else to debate and talk about in this structured way. Now, one of the reasons we chose this system, it's because it's been used and field tested in many other areas, is one reason. And as part of our work, we wanted to investigate a little bit more about why that was, why it might be useful. So we have developed over time a list of five key areas and key benefits that actually we think that Polis is useful. And things like it generates new ideas, things like it's good for getting antagonistic groups to engage with each other, and various other reasons as well. And we take those to our commissioners, and that forms part of the key features that would be useful for them. I mean, I can go into those a bit more if you like, but...
I think I'd love to hear more in connection with a specific example. Can you tell us about one, I don't know whether you want to call it a dialogue or a series of dialogues or what term you use to describe it. Could you give us one of these examples? Who was the audience and what was the kind of discussion you ended up having? And frankly, did it work?
I'm happy to pick up on that. I'll give you a couple of examples. So one of the hypotheses we have is that using Polis with public servants, with subject matter experts, with members of the public, will help generate new ideas compared with other forms of engagement. And we don't have a direct counterfactual to what I'm about to describe, but about 2 years ago, the UK published an international strategy blending foreign policy and national security and other aspects. It's a public-facing document. And so what we did, we asked civil servants, officials working in that kind of space, to join with subject matter experts in academia and others, and members of the public. And we asked them to have a discussion about what UK's kind of foreign stance should be, international stance should be. And I guess the thing that we were probing there is both, does this kind of engagement generate the kind new ideas that might come out from the cross-pollination of statements that are put in anonymously by people from experts or from members of the public? And we were also trying to tease out where different groups of people might agree on. One of Polis's kind of key features we wanted to test is the extent to which it draws consensus out from people who just come from different backgrounds. And to your question as to whether it worked, we certainly had some very lively discussions with thousands of statements submitted by participants, tens of thousands of votes cast. And in that case, it worked in the sense that we were able to derive personalities or personas, user personas, from the groupings that Polis gives us. As a piece of software, I don't think we mentioned it, but it runs some machine learning to cluster groups of participants together according to how they vote. So we were able to say that groups of people in these debates who had particular views on a subset, a subtopic in this arena, they had particular personal or professional demographics. And so we were able to use that to inform the update to that kind of international strategy that was going on at the time. So in that sense, certainly it worked. There are another example touching off what Brendan was talking about, bringing people who otherwise have differing views together. We worked on a policy recently on a topic that's quite contentious in the UK, being an island, which is fisheries policy. And we brought people who are known to have opposing, if not opposing, then certainly very different views on topics in this arena, brought people together from different specialisms and found that, you know, surprise, more often than not, people agreed on many of the statements that were put in. And crucially, because you're anonymous, you don't know whether the government's put a statement in, whether a peer has put a statement in, someone from the quote opposing camp has put a statement. So I think this the arriving of consensus there was very interesting too, as well as generating specific things that policymakers could then roll out into regulation.
In terms of the output that you had at the end, what you were delivering to a minister or whoever was listening, can you tell us a little bit more about sort of what is the product that resulted? A lot of the people listening, we hope, are people who are interested in trying engagement for themselves, who may work in institutions and are very interested in the question of which horse for which course, which tool do I use for which purpose, or which process do I use for which outcome? So the more that you can tell us really about what it led to, I think that would be extraordinarily helpful. And also, if you have any further reflections on having done this now a number of times, what policy is really good for and what it's not good for?
What I'll do, I'll give you a high level view of the kind of outputs we've done. And then Brendan, perhaps you can talk about some of the more data-y, dashboard-y outputs we've started and why we've decided to deploy POLIS in the particular way that we have. So one of the benefits that POLIS brings, and in terms of which horse for which course, the fact that it clusters participants together into according to the way they vote on statements gives you the ability to start, if you have sufficient numbers participating, to start thinking which subsections of your population have which opinions, and you can start to get under the skin of perhaps motivations or personas. So in more than one debate, I think in two or three debates, we have produced off the back of the groupings personas of different groups of debate participants. And this helps bring to life some of the opinions that come out from these discussions. I think we've also had a really interesting example with one of our projects where we were asking participants to talk about the future of the decision-making system around the water system in the UK, right out 20 years from now. How will decisions about water be taken? How should decisions about water be taken? And what was interesting in that debate is we had a lot of people telling us about the way the decision-making system and its governance should be designed, and a lot of people telling us what kinds of decisions should be taken from a new system. And I think what was interesting there is people really gave us both high-level answers and really granular detail too, both of which are really useful for policymakers. And that's been used for informing some co-design that's gone on later down the line. In terms of the outputs, Brendan, perhaps you could talk about some of the data that comes out from the back end, as it were, and how we present that to our kind of policymaking clients and our analyst clients.
Sure. Yeah. So because it's a it's a highly statistical system. It generates a lot of data. So if there's anyone out there who's sort of really into that kind of thing, then, you know, this is a fantastic way to generate huge amounts of data, which, you know, obviously it's the kind of real bread and butter of data analysts. And we do find that with some of the policy teams, that's the kind of thing that they want to see. So they can then get the data and just run with it internally and process it in their own ways. We do a bit of that ourselves as well, and we process that into a dashboard, which is essentially a way to cut that data coupled with demographics. So one thing we should say actually is, as part of the onboarding process to our policy debates, we ask people to fill in a short questionnaire which has some policy related demographic data in there, which is set out by the policy teams to enrich in that. And that serves several purposes. One of those is to really sort of give a little bit more insight into those personas that Pratik mentioned earlier. But also it really helps us generate these rich data sets where we can see which particular groups within those demographics agree, which ones disagree, where the consensus lies. And yeah, it kind of informs that. So yeah, we provide that output. Obviously, we usually have a bit of a write-up, a report, that kind of thing. And yeah, in terms of what policies is good for and what it isn't, budgeting, quite difficult to say, participatory budgeting. Policy is great for things like what kind of things could be budgeted, you know, so potholes, I think we should fill in potholes, or I think we should focus on housing, that kind of thing. It's not great for arriving at values. So it's because all these bits of data live discreetly, you can never sort of really get an oversight of the whole system. So it is good for some things, but not other problems. So and definitely balancing books and budgeting and numbers and that kind of stuff, it's not what it's great at.
Further thoughts from you about what it's not good at?
So we're still taking stock of our 18 months or so of experimentation ourselves. And I think in our experience, what it's been good at is generating a lively discussion on topics where perhaps the usual suspects may have raised their 2 cents worth, as it were. But generating lively discussions amongst experts and members of the public on kind of detailed topics. We're quite aware of the power of the software, and we're actually working to some degree, because it's an open source project, with the developers who originated it to kind of improve it and to make it kind of fit for scale, which is sort of our ambition with this. At the moment, we operate on an invitation only basis for a number of reasons, but our ambition is, where appropriate, to take it to scale. But we're also aware, as every project we do, we come across limitations, and every tool has its limitations. Some of them are really pragmatic and practical. So one of the things, because we're working for the UK government, we invite participants to submit statements, but we moderate them. So we have 7 fairly light touch criteria: don't be offensive, don't be too repetitive, and so on, just to keep the debate kind of on topic and keep it civil, frankly. And so obviously, because when we moderate debates, it's very manual, it's very time intensive. Some of the debates, you know, per participant, people might submit dozens, hundreds of statements. So on any given day, we may have to sift through hundreds, thousands of statements to moderate, and that's very time intensive. So there's a limitation around kind of some of the mechanics, if you like, of the debate. And there are also some kinds of interesting limitations, although perhaps they're actually strengths, about doing this purely in an anonymized setting. And we're quite aware that through, well, frankly, your work, of course, Beth, and your listeners' work, but also through other initiatives that people like Nestor are curating, that there's no limitation to the number of tools in this kind of space. We're really, really keen to learn from everything we've done in the last 18 months and then see what other tools might be applicable for different kinds of problems. Yeah, I think I'll leave it there.
So just two last questions from me. The first is, how are you using the feedback that you're getting at this point? Is it still very experimental? You talked about the ability to kind of identify personas and essentially see where people kind of lie on a given issue. What are the clusters of opinion? How would you describe the way in which this is informing policy processes or other service delivery at this point?
I think the best way to put it is, from our side, it remains experimental. And every new project we take on, we are trying to test kind of an internal hypothesis of ours. Like, is it appropriate with this topic, or is it appropriate with this group of people? For the clients, in many ways, they are receiving, I guess, one of two things. One is content that they can use to design policy, and that might be content they wouldn't have otherwise, ideas they may not have otherwise got, or indeed road testing ideas that they have for future policy directions. And I think the other thing they're getting, in a sense, and this is me editorializing ever so slightly, but it's almost a sense of confidence that on particular topics that may seem pretty complex on paper, you know, the future of the water system, for example, or national security, it is possible to engage subject matter experts, and far more in numbers than you would around a round table. It is possible to engage with members of the public when you might have not thought about it. So there's a sense almost of confidence that policymakers are saying it is okay to do some of this through a tool of this nature. That's a little bit woolly, but I think that's a really important kind of proof of concept. If we feel that other methods of collective intelligence are going to play a role in policymaking, actually taking that first step is a really important thing.
And so do you have a vision for where you hope this will go? So even if you aren't there yet in terms of, you know, the full integration of collective intelligence in every decision that the government takes, tell us a little bit about what that roadmap looks like, or in other words, what's next for you and for the Collective Intelligence Lab? Where do you see it going, and what is the broader vision down the line?
I think we might split that question into two parts, if we may. Brendan, do you want to talk about kind of product roadmap and features you think we want to add to POLIS as a tool? And I might come back in and talk about the kind of broader possibilities.
Sure, yes. So POLIS, of course, is an open source project. So we've been, and we've actually been quite spoiled, because just on our doorstep in Bethnal Green, we have some civic hacker groups who are really interested in this. And we've been going out there, we've been engaging with them, we've been going along to their meetups and things. And we've had some really great progress so far with getting POLIS into a state where we can add the kind of features and the kind of tools that we'd like to. So we put down some groundwork and we published that back as an open source project. And that's really laid the ground for some of the stuff that we want to do going forwards. And that includes things like some integrations with some of the government systems, things like GovNotify, GovSignIn. So that's the sign-in process, as well as the sending out SMSs, things like that, and other notifications, just to remind people to get them onto the system, to keep them into that daily routine, because different new statements come out every day. And then as well, we really want to refine our outputs. So we have a good sense, which we've built over the past 18 months, about the kind of things that people are interested in. So showing those personas in a really appealing way, really highlighting those novel ideas, you know, bubbling them up from the thousands of statements that you get and are generated in the system. And various other bits and pieces that we want to really sort of put together into an appealing report in a semi-automated way. So I think for us, it's going to be building that pipeline together, getting that together, and making it so that it's a bit more hands off at the moment, because we really have to get stuck into every debate and set time aside at the moment. So we're really keen to sort of bring it to that next level in automation.
And Well, I lied about my two questions. I will cheat and ask one last one, which is I'm really excited to also ask you, as you've experimented with these, with this tool in particular, and really it's more than one tool because you're re-engineering the plane while you're flying it, shaping how it will work. I'm excited to see what this instance of Polis looks like and how you're developing it. Can you envision a world in which you are using multiple tools for different purposes, or will you continue to build this one out, or will do you see yourself as having a kind of a toolkit of different things that plug and play together? So in other words, the reflection on, given the reticence of policymakers and public servants to do engagement in the first place, is the most we can hope for to do one engagement, or do you see the possibility for doing multiple forms of engagement with different kinds of processes and platforms?
I think it's
a leading question.
it's a very good question, and it's a live one for us on two counts. Policy Lab, as I mentioned, we're a project-driven team. We're effectively an internal consultancy within government. So we other parts of government pay us for our time, and so to some extent we have to take a call on the amount of development time it's taken, the skills that Brendan's brought to kind of get the tool to this stage. How do we best develop the technical capability to take this tool to the next level? And to ask the kind of strategic question of, do we turn this one thing into a really compelling service that people can, across government, can just pick off the shelf and deploy into their kind of service design or policy making journey? Other options, they're not mutually exclusive, but the other options are, we know that there are other tools out there that we want to explore and that will likely bring other types of value. It's a live question. We are debating this in our team right now. What I would say is, one thing to consider is that there is reticence to some degree to doing public engagement. I certainly can only speak of experience here in the UK, but there are pockets of government where the barriers are somewhat lower to some degree. And that might be in local government or city level regional government, where perhaps the distance between the resident and their concerns or issues is just that much less. So we're quite excited about the possibility of working with kind of city level public authorities. It may be actually in areas where there is greatest complexity and uncertainty, where the marginal value add of a tool of this nature is just that much more. So I think we're really interested in that. And to your question on kind of the future toolkit, for speaking personally, there is no single way of engaging with residents or with experts or with any group of people, because there's no single problem we're all seeking to solve. So the future almost certainly would hold different kinds of tools. And by the way, different kinds of deployment methods too. Something we've only just tried on one occasion, but you know, using Polis, for instance, in an in-person workshop brings a very different dynamic to doing it purely remotely or asynchronously. And we're really looking to integrate, whether it's Polis or other collective intelligence tools, with Policy Lab's big long list of other methods, whether it's co-design or speculative futures or ethnography. These methods in collective intelligence could fit at any stage along a long kind of journey where you're helping a department make a whole series of decisions over months. So I think these methods might play a role really integrating with some deeper kind of methods too. But it's to be seen, because we are taking these decisions as we speak.
Well, I am super excited to hear about the work that you're going to do going forward. Already what you've been doing is a tremendous service to all of us who care deeply about the ways in which we can use technology to deepen democracy. So excited to hear about the learnings coming out of this. And we'll be glad to share links and references along with this recording for those who are listening or those who are watching. And hope we can share lessons going forward. So thank you, Pratik. Brendan, thank you so much for joining us and for your willingness to share more about the important work. that you're undertaking, and we'll be back soon with another episode of the Collective Intelligence Podcast. So thanks to everyone for listening and for watching, and don't forget to subscribe. Please also subscribe and follow the Burns Center and the GovLab on Twitter to stay updated on our work. Thank you, everybody.